I'm broadcasting live from Monday Night Garage Brewery in Atlanta's West End. We are near the Atlanta University Center, right along the Atlanta Beltline West Side Trail. Today's All Things Considered is all about Georgia's alcohol culture and history. And it's not too late for you to come on down and join us. We'd love to meet you and hear why you're a big fan of public radio and GPB. We're at 933 Lee Street. This is near the West End MARTA station. There's probably 500 to 600 people. We just got the latest headcount from the managers here. An extraordinary turnout, and I think that that speaks to how passionate Atlantans are about public radio. Breweries are a big dollar business in Georgia, but alcohol does take a toll on the economy. GPB intern Isabeth Mendoza explains.
In 2010, excessive alcohol use cost the U.S. nearly $250 billion. That's about $2 for every drink sold. In addition to healthcare and criminal justice costs, the largest economic impact of excessive drinking is lost workplace productivity. In Georgia, the cost translates to about $700 per person. The highest cost is nearly double that in the District of Columbia. For GPB News, I'm Isabeth Mendoza.
So we have come a long way from 1733, when Georgia was founded as a dry colony of England. Georgia does get its name from King George, after all. So views on drinking, of course, have evolved over time, as have the laws that govern alcohol in our state. GPB interns Kevin Kilgore and Isabeth Mendoza bring us this history of alcohol in Georgia, starting with General James Oglethorpe.
Native American tribes across the lands that would become Georgia made their own fermented beverages long before James Oglethorpe arrived on the shore in 1733. But due to the colony's financial ties to England, Georgia was to be, by law, dry. After 12 years as governor, Oglethorpe couldn't take it anymore. He hopped on a boat for England with a list of demands and successfully ended the war on drinking.
Georgia becomes a state following the Revolutionary War, and alcohol use continues to thrive thanks to the adoption of railroads. In 1837, the city of Terminus, now known as Atlanta, springs to life. Railroads lead to ice, ice to better brewing to taverns, and from taverns come saloons. These drinking establishments gained immense popularity.
So much so that things quickly got out of hand. In short, saloons were wild. Temperance groups gained momentum as the social cost of alcohol consumption grew increasingly more apparent.
The Civil War put temperance on hold. After the war, it came back with a vengeance. In 1887, Atlanta city officials passed legislation that made liquor and beer licenses a luxury item few could afford.
In the decades to follow, the movement mixed politics, alcohol, and race, fueled in part by racist allegations that blamed immigrant and African-American saloons for a 1906 race riot. Within 2 years, alcohol was banned statewide. In the next 10 years, so were saloons and breweries. Prohibition went viral in the late 19-teens with the passage of the 18th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. This held little significance to already dry Georgians and only took the state Senate 4.5 minutes to ratify the change. The passage of the 21st Amendment in 1933 came and went with similar apathy as Georgia clung to prohibition for another 5 years.
With alcohol off the shelves, moonshine took center stage. In order to transport the beverage from hidden distilleries to bigger city centers like Atlanta and outrun the police if need be, distributors customized the rides with turbocharged engines. As it turns out, banning alcohol is pretty easy, but actually stopping people from drinking? Well, that's another matter entirely.
It took some time for the city of Atlanta to shake off the ghost of prohibition past, and it wasn't until the 1990s that the city's beer culture began to take off. Atlanta Brewing, now known as Red Brick, was the state's oldest operating craft brewery. The brewery's name change in 2010 was attributed to a speech from Atlanta Mayor James M. Calhoun during the Civil War, where he said the city would rise from the ashes and its infrastructure built one red brick at a time.
Now, I'm pretty sure Calhoun wasn't referring to alcohol when he made his remarks.
But there have been several laws passed that benefit brewers and consumers in Georgia.
Most notably, in 2011, cities and counties across the state could decide whether or not to sell alcohol on Sundays.
Last fall, Georgia became the last state in the country to allow breweries to sell directly to customers. That has led to an explosive growth of breweries and brew pubs. Since 2014, the number has doubled to more than 60 statewide. For GPB News, I'm Isabeth Mendoza.
And I'm Kevin Kilgore.
And you can see a timeline of Isabeth and Kevin's alcohol history at gpb.org/alcohol. And a great shout out to our GPB Radio interns, Kevin and Isabeth. They did such a great job on that story, and they've done a great job on this entire show. Our next generation of journalists. All right. So Georgians have long had the right to drink alcohol, but not without some restrictions. It was only 7 years ago when lawmakers legalized Sunday alcohol sales. And even then, you can only buy a drink on Sunday after 12:30. This, of course, puts a damper on people who want to booze while they brunch. On a recent Sunday morning, GPB Stephen Fowler dropped by a busy restaurant to dig into the culture of brunch.
It's nearly 1:30 p.m., and Lindsay Grubbs is thankful for two things, her friends and the cocktail in front of her. As law school students, the group of women use brunch to catch up and unwind from the stresses of the week. But their theoretical lessons took on a more practical tone when they tried to order drinks.
Well, we came and made our reservation at 11:30, thinking that was the time that you can order alcohol. And then she told us that the bar didn't open till later. So we ordered food and then said, come back over whenever the bar opens.
We're at 10th and Piedmont, where fried chicken and waffles, bottomless mimosas, and upbeat music swirl together into the perfect stereotype for a Sunday brunch. But there's more than meets the eye, both for the restaurant and the luxurious midday meal.
Historically, the first mention of brunch literally was in England.
That's Farah Turniker, an associate professor of sociology at Le Moyne College in New York. She wrote the book on brunch in 2014 and says the meal started as this midday celebration by the English elite after a morning of hunting. Brunch back then represented this sort of fancy special status, hearty foods, and a break from the norm. Today,
I think it still symbolizes decadence, indulgence, anything goes at brunch, right? It's like the one meal where you could have cake and, you know, alcohol and bacon.
In the U.S., New Orleans and New York kicked off the brunch scene as a conspicuous sign of taste in every sense of the word. Fast forward to the 1920s, and brunch appears in etiquette guides and advice columns. A 1939 article in the New York Times declares Sunday a two-meal day. Turniker says until the late 80s, brunch was still a primarily white and well-to-do meal, and pop culture reflected that. Take this scene from The Simpsons, where the fancy bowling instructor Jacques Cousteau tries to take the married Marge Simpson out on a date to brunch.
What's brunch?
You'd love it. It's not quite breakfast. It's not quite lunch, but it comes with a slice of cantaloupe at the end. You don't get completely what you would at breakfast, but you get a good meal.
I don't think so.
Back at 10th and Piedmont, there may not be cantaloupe, but you will find an eclectic mix of people that decidedly don't fit the definition of a historic brunching crowd. Sybil Penix, an African-American woman, is one of them. She's celebrating her birthday with her sisters and says she loves brunch for its relaxing atmosphere and accessibility to anyone.
Across the board, as you see sitting next to us is an 80-year-old couple. It's everybody can enjoy brunch. It's all different genres, different people, different walks of life, different colors, different ages. Everybody can brunch. It's like the time of the day that gives you life.
That's music to the ears of Gilbert Uramian, owner of 10th and Piedmont. He says popularity of brunch has transcended Sunday afternoons and crept over into other days of the week.
Yeah, people love our brunch, and we sometimes do specials on evenings of Monday or Tuesday, and brunch is always part of the menu in some way.
Brunch has evolved from a meal of the hunting elite to an integral part of many people's weekend routine. But the TV show Seinfeld still asks a great question about the name.
So what's the deal with brunch? I mean, if it's a combination of breakfast and lunch, how come there's no leper or no linner?
For GPB News, I'm Stephen Fowler in Atlanta.
Very important question indeed. I love the woman in that story who just said, brunch is the only meal where you can drink alcohol, eat cake, and bacon all in the same meal. So whether or not you do like to drink on Sunday morning, we want to know, what is your brunch personality? You can take our brunch personality quiz. It's up now at gpb.org/alcohol. Monday Night Brewing is one of Atlanta's most well-known craft breweries. And joining me now to talk about the history of the organization and about what it's like to be a brewer in Georgia is Joel Iverson. He is a co-founder of Monday Night Brewing, and he is chief operating officer. Thank you for joining me. So I think most people think that being in the brew business is like really glamorous, right? So I'm just going to start right off and say, what is the hardest part about running a brewery?
So I think we started out thinking, you know, the hardest part is going to be just building a business and doing all those things. And then as we got into this 6 years ago, we realized actually the hardest part was these crazy Georgia laws that we were having to deal with. And we actually couldn't even sell a beer to someone walking into our brewery. We could only sell them kind of a pint glass and give them a tour and kind of give them some samples. And that that was something that was just way harder than we ever imagined.
I think most people in Georgia wouldn't even know what you're talking about, right? I mean, 2011 was the big Sunday sales law. I mean, I think everybody remembers that because it was the moment when most counties in Georgia voted to allow Sunday sales. And yet, it's actually opened a watershed of many, many subsequent bills that have been tiny incremental changes in the way that beer is distributed and the way that, and therefore the way that we drink beer. So talk about that process just in the last, 7 years since 2011?
Yeah, really, the first change was about 3 years ago when you could actually walk into a brewery and take a six-pack of beer home. And that was a huge step, trying to convince lawmakers that if you could take a six-pack home from a brewery, the whole world would collapse. and so we got that change done about 3 years ago. It took kind of all the craft breweries rallying. People all across the state kind of came together and rallied, and we got that change done. And then in September, for the first time, we changed the law where you could actually buy a beer when you come to the brewery. Just buy a pint and come in. And, you know, one of the great things here is, you know, people can walk in and they can buy a mini beer, they can buy a pint, they can buy a half pint, they can buy a tasting. Before, we could only sell people a quote-unquote tour and kind of sell them a pint glass, and it was this crazy cockamamie system. We were the last state out of 50 states to allow a brewery to sell beer, so that's kind of crazy.
Wow, I didn't actually know that, and I've done a lot of research on this topic, so thank you for enlightening me and our listening audience. So cockamamie is a word that you just used to describe Georgia's beer laws. Why has it been like this?
So alcohol is what's considered sort of a regulated industry. You know, there's a lot of government involvement, whether from a tax perspective or how it flows through the whole system. And leading up to Prohibition was a reaction to sort of this unregulated industry and saloons and chaos. And so coming out of Prohibition, there were a bunch of really interesting laws that went in place, and some of them were meant to sort of protect against the mayhem of pre-Prohibition, but some of them were meant to protect states from big national brewers who could do things like run saloons in their local communities and not have any responsibility. And really, the change has been to go back to allowing reasonable laws so that a brewery can be in a community, they can sell beer to people in the community, and they can do it responsibly and do it in a way that's beneficial to everybody.
So speaking of community, how many people are here tonight?
So we're probably at about 600 or 700 people here so far. So people are here for, let's give it up for Georgia Public Broadcasting and NPR.
All right. I'm assuming they're here for us. And
they're here for you, Ricky. They are here for you.
You're just offering it.
Y'all are missing. People come up. They want to snap pictures.
Oh,
she's kind of a rock star.
Well, we've been inviting people to follow the show. If you can't make it down here, you can go on social media at Ricky Bevington and GPB News on Facebook and Twitter and see our pictures. And, of course, gpb.org/alcohol. So how many beers does Monday Night Brewing produce?
So in an individual year, we'll make about, probably last year made about 5 or 6 million beers.
Like individual beers?
Individual beers.
Where do they go? Do they go all over the world? Or?
No, just Georgia and then parts of Alabama is all we sell in right now. And we're really kind of, we're not trying to be a big national brand. We're very dedicated to kind of the city and to Georgia. We're the, I think, first brewery to in Georgia to build a second location, and our two locations are only 5 miles from each other. And it's really because we're kind of doubling down on Atlanta and on the opportunity here and really on kind of our mission of what we're trying to do as a business.
So if you can sell 5 to 6 million beers a year just in Georgia and maybe in the immediate vicinity, what does that say about Georgia beer consumers?
We're getting there. So, now I think that Georgia's got a long way to go. If you think about the stat that I like to use is that Colorado and Oregon have the same legal drinking age population, people that are 21 plus. Those two states combined have the same legal drinking age population as the entire state of Georgia. So those states have about 800 breweries. We have about 60 right now in the state. So we've got a lot of room for small local community craft breweries to pop up across the state and kind of be a hub and a good neighbor.
So why aren't you trying to be a big national brewery? You just want to stay local right here on the West Side.
We do. I think it kind of comes back to our purpose of deepening human relationships, making really good beer, and to some extent, staying small and staying here and focused on the city allows us to do that better. It's more about making the beer and having people in. Big brewers become more about advertising and kind of messaging and all that stuff, and we just like doing what we're doing.
Joel Iverson is CEO and co-founder of Monday Night Brewing. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Ricky.
This is the time when I thank everybody for turning out tonight to watch public radio happen live before your eyes. Give yourselves a great round of applause. Thank you for being here. About 600 to 700 people, the CEO just said. And of course, thanks to the folks at Monday Night Garage for having us here tonight. Our GPB team, we've got to thank Bradley George, Ellen Reinhart, Lane Sterrett, Summer Evans, and GPB's Vice President of Radio, Tanya Ott. And this show was produced by Stephen Fowler and executive produced by yours truly. We also have Tyler Morris here on the board. We've got plenty of other people to thank. Again, you can find out more information about GPB Atlanta at gpb.org. And again, on Twitter and Facebook at GPB News. And thanks, I'm looking over here to our communications department. Thanks to Rachel and Mandy and Emily for running our trivia tonight. We had some great giveaways. I'm Ricky Bevington, broadcasting live from Monday Night Garage. Have a wonderful weekend.